Welcome to Island Watch. Each week, we'll explore an island by watching a TV show or a movie. Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale. Hi, I'm Gemma Voss.
And I'm Dave Zark. Welcome to Island Watch, the podcast that virtually visits islands all over the world. This week, we're traveling between Jamaica and England by watching the TV miniseries Small Island. All aboard! So here we are, sailing between Jamaica and the United Kingdom. But it's not the modern-day UK or Jamaica. As part of the British Empire, Jamaicans were educated to revere the motherland, England, and they were expected to feel that was where their ultimate duty lay.
I relate to that as a Canadian, as that's most definitely how things were arranged here as well. Gilbert and Hortense are the two main Jamaican characters in Small Island, and they're brought up to believe they are British. Their education, the history they learned in school, it's all about Britain, not Jamaica. So eventually when they arrive in Britain, it's a shock to them both that they are seen and treated as foreigners. And no one in Britain seems to understand or even know about Jamaica. A lot of British people at the time, if they gave it any thought at all, believed Jamaica was in Africa. So there was not a great deal of understanding of the Caribbean or the importance of the role that it played in British history.
Jamaica was a British colony at the time. It wouldn't gain independence until 1962, and at the time it was struggling economically, because back in the 30s, during the Depression, there was widespread unemployment because of the economic downturn, and that was exacerbated by low sugar prices, banana crop failures, a rapidly growing population, and limited migration opportunities. And there was also discontent at the slow pace of political advance. It was only in 1944, during the war, that the first general elections were held there.
Most of the story of Small Island takes place after the war, and 1948 is a pivotal year in that. So 1948 was the year that the SS Empire Windrush, a former troop ship, sailed from Jamaica to England, carrying hundreds of West Indian migrants. And though the initial sailing only carried 500 people, the Windrush became the name of a generation of immigrants to the UK. And they were called the Windrush Generation. So the Windrush came to symbolize the start of immigration from the Caribbean and Britain becoming a much more multicultural society than it had been before the war. Gilbert Joseph, who's one of the main characters in Small Island, actually immigrates to the UK aboard the Windrush. And if you'd like to know more about the Windrush, just go to our show notes. We've got a link to watching a documentary about it.
A couple of years ago in Britain, there was something called the Windrush scandal. So this legacy continues. It was a political scandal that concerned people who were wrongly detained and denied their legal rights, threatened with deportation, and in some cases, actual deportation, because many of the people affected were born British subjects and they'd arrived in the UK before 1973, particularly from Caribbean countries, members of that so-called Windrush generation. I think this is relevant to Small Island and our conversation here because this scandal raised a lot of very pertinent issues and it demonstrated that Britain hasn't entirely moved past its racist and colonialist past.
You're probably getting the sense that this is an epic story and based on people's real experiences, and that's exactly what Small Island is. Even though it was a fictional book, a 2004 novel by British author Andrea Levy, it is definitely grounded in real life, and the film was made in short order after the book was released. The show itself was released in 2009 as a two-episode TV show totaling 3 hours. The novel itself scooped up several major literary prizes. It got the Orange Prize for Women's Fiction, Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and the Whitbread Book of the Year Award. So, as we mentioned, the story is set before and after World War II, and one of the things that sets it apart from many British productions about this period is that much of the story is about post-war Caribbean migration. The main characters are two couples. There's Hortense and Gilbert, whose story is much more complex than just saying they migrate from Jamaica to London in 1948.
Similarly, There's a lot of complexity in the story of Queenie and Bernard, the white English couple who Gilbert and Hortense meet. But to keep things simple, we'll say they first met Queenie and Bernard through finding lodgings at their London house.
It's interesting, the author of this book, Andrea Levy, she was born in England. Her parents had both immigrated from Jamaica in 1948. Sound familiar? It's around the same time the two Jamaican leads in Small Island also immigrate to the UK. So actually, Andrea Levy's father came over aboard the Windrush. She's really writing about what she knows. She notes that her parents really didn't talk a lot about their time in Jamaica. And I think that's something that a lot of people whose parents are immigrants know about, or even grandparents are immigrants. There's an article from the British Library that I think puts the experience of the immigrants into context. And I think it has so much resonance to many stories of immigration. It doesn't matter if it was 1948 to the UK or anywhere else, but I'm just going to quote from it here. The silence of those that experienced the traumatic events of post-war migration to Britain is examined in discussions of trauma literature, which harnesses the concept of belatedness. Belatedness is a theory that hinges on the crisis in witnessing, central to traumatic events such as the Holocaust, slavery, and migration. Belatedness indicates the ways in which it is often the members of the next generation who articulate the traumas of those who've gone before. The voices of the older generation may have been silenced by their own trauma, historical rupture, and/or lack of platform on which to speak. There may be various impetuses for belatedly recounting or reconstructing these narratives as an act of mourning, as a way to make sense of difficult events, or to create or reinforce a shared contemporary cultural identity. It is this instinct to return and reconstruct which Levy develops in Small Island, using narrators from both Jamaica and England, who are deeply affected, personally and ideologically, by their encounters with each other. For the Windrush generation, this trauma was the pervasive popular and institutional racist rejection experienced by so many who journeyed to Britain, having anticipated finding the open arms of a welcoming mother country.
Well, in fact, Andrea Levy herself said in an interview in 2004, she said, "When I started Small Island, I didn't intend to write about the war. I wanted to start in 1948 with two women, one white, one black, in a house in Earl's Court. But when I asked myself, who are these people and how did they get there? I realized that 1948 was so very close to the war that nothing made sense without it. If every writer in Britain were to write about the war years, there would still be stories to be told, and none of us would come close to what really happened. It was such an amazing schism in the middle of the century. And Caribbean people got left out of the telling of that story, so I am attempting to put them back into it. But I am not telling it from only a Jamaican point of view. I want to tell stories from the black and white experience. It's a shared history."
Have you checked out our blog at islandwatchpodcast.com? You'll find show notes and extras like Island Hopping, which lets you know what other island-related shows the cast appears in. My favorite, though, is our Island Watch Picnic Picks, specially customized to complement each show we watch. And what better way to spend time at home? You whip up some special island treats and you watch a great show. How about some Moana-inspired Kahlua pig?
Just don't eat it in front of your pet pig like she slipped up and did.
Yeah, that was not her best moment. Okay, but how about some Newfoundland purity cream crackers and wine and cheese to soak up all the atmosphere of episode 3's Grand Seduction? Or you could get your greens together for a koala mukbang in Izzy's Koala World, our first mini episode.
Feast your eyes and your palate with Island Watch Picnic Picks.
So it really didn't take long from the publication of Small Island in 2004 until it was released as the show in 2009. That's pretty fast-moving stuff. They did not cut corners when it came to casting. It's clear that only the very top tier of actors were chosen for this show, for this production. Yeah, I'd say there's no false notes in the casting. The four leads really shine. And so we thought we would take a dive into how their careers have fared since then.
In the role of Hortense Roberts is Naomi Harris. She is a British actor. She has appeared in such films as 28 Days Later and two of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. After appearing in Small Island, she went on to play Winnie Mandela in Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. And she was nominated for an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and a BAFTA award for her role in the critically acclaimed film Moonlight.
Yeah, her portrayal of the mother in Moonlight, it's loosely based on the director's mom who became addicted to drugs. It just rips your heart out. And the crazy thing is, she had to shoot the entire 15 years worth of her character's development in just 3 days because she had visa problems as a Brit filming in the US.
Also, Naomi has played Eve Moneypenny in the James Bond films Skyfall and Spectre and will reprise the role in the forthcoming No Time to Die.
Let's move on to actor Ruth Wilson, who plays Queenie Bligh in Small Island. Ruth is an English actor, and she has a real, fearlessness about her. A couple of examples of how that's played out in her prolific career. She was in the Showtime series The Affair. It was this really raw, arresting tale told from multiple points of view. She won a Golden Globe for her lead performance, but then she suddenly was just gone 3 seasons in. And there was a real mystery around why did she leave? It turns out she signed an NDA on leaving, and there's been a lot of talk, not just from her, about the show's toxic environment. So there's definitely more to the story there. But just a couple of years after leaving The Affair, though, she starred in a show called Mrs. Wilson. Well, really, she was letting skeletons out of the family closet because the Mrs. Wilson of the show's title was Ruth's own grandmother, Ellison. Have you heard about this?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
So, during World War II, Ellison was working as a secretary in the British intelligence agency, MI6, and she met a man there. He was a spy. Her apartment was bombed out in the Blitz, and then that meant moving into his flat. They eventually married. That's not the scandalous part of the story, though. After her husband died suddenly in the 1960s, Ellison opened the door to a stranger on her doorstep who claimed to be her husband's real wife. And then the story unfolded that not only was her husband a foreign intelligence agent and best-selling author, he was a bigamist. So Ruth Wilson took this story and made it into a 3-part series she executive produced and starred in, and she played the role of her grandmother, Ellison.
Well, that's really cool for her to be willing to dig into those skeletons in the family closet. Of course, Naomi and Ruth aren't the only heavy hitters in Small Island. Benedict Cumberbatch plays Bernard Bligh. And before Small Island, he made prolific appearances on the stage in England, as well as British TV shows and movies. He often played historical roles, such as William Pitt the Younger, Soviet spy Guy Burgess, and scientist Stephen Hawking. And of course, he's become world famous in the last decade for roles such as Sherlock Holmes in the BBC TV series Sherlock, the villain Khan Noonien Singh in Star Trek Into Darkness, the voice of Smaug the Dragon in the Hobbit movies, and Dr. Stephen Strange in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I stopped at Sherlock Holmes. I loved that show. And I think that's when I first kind of became aware of who he was. That was still in the days when people were getting his name mixed up with Cumberbund, you know? Not anymore. That's not a problem anymore. Rounding out the 4 main leads of Small Island is David Oyelowo, who plays Gilbert Joseph. Just like the Cumberbatch situation, there are certain parts of the world who need a little time to get themselves familiar with his last name, like this clip from the Jimmy Fallon show demonstrates.
Oyelowo.
Yes.
Now, this is a Nigerian name?
It is a Nigerian name.
Am I saying it correctly?
You're saying it correctly for Europe and America. My dad will watch this and be mortified because it's actually Oyelowo. Is how you say it. But if I were to say that, don't try. Don't even go there.
I don't know what's going to happen. No, I really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
I had a...
Yeah. No! Oprah was on. She taught the nation how to do it. Let's stick with Oyelowo.
And if you're interested in seeing the rest of that clip, we'll have a link to it on our show notes. David is a British-American actor, and you probably would recognize him from the 2014 film Selma, where he played the lead as Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He's had several notable leads in other films, and on the TV side of things, he played Javert in the 2018 BBC adaptation of Les Miserables. But the movie he made that I'm most interested in watching next is, because I soaked up The Queen's Gambit on Netflix way too quickly, I'm looking for other chess-related movies, and David is one of the stars of The Queen of Katwa, which is the based-on-real-life story of a young girl from Uganda rising through the chess-playing ranks to become national champion, and David plays her coach. I saw the previews, and it looks like a really good film. I guess if I'm mentioning shows we want to watch, we should probably get on with our tale of the day here, Small Island.
For Small Island, we're going to take a slightly different approach. Rather than focusing so much on the plot, we're going to take a deeper dive into the characters who these actors play.
So first up, we're going to take a look at Hortense Robert, played by Naomi Harris. Hortense is, wow, let's just put this on the table right here. Did you like her as a character?
Not really. I thought she seemed kind of stuck up.
Yes. She's one of those people I think I would say I admire, but I wouldn't necessarily like them. I admire her forcefulness, her will, but she's definitely, like you said, she's got that haughty side to her, which you don't see immediately. When we first meet her, she's a young woman living out in the countryside in Jamaica. She's got a great big fat crush on a distant cousin. She's living in a very religious household, and they've taken her in. Her parents' situation is complicated, but basically, they've taken her in, and it's out of duty more than kindness. It's not a very loving household. So she seems kind of sweet at first, but you quickly see that she is kind of a powder keg mixture of sheltered, haughty, like you mentioned, and she's so focused that she nearly sounds like a broken record. She's really obsessive. She dreams obsessively of taking her teaching credentials and making it big in England.
I will be a teacher in a fine English school, and I will live in a fine house with electric lights and a bell at the front door, and I will ring that bell. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. It's a dream Michael and I share since we're children. When the war is over, he will realize his mistake and come back for me.
From what you tell, he's not one to learn from his mistake, Hortense.
He'll be back. You will see. This island is too small if you have big dreams, Celia. And without dreams, we are nothing.
Well, things don't quite go according to plan, even with Hortense's iron will. Instead, she winds up marrying Gilbert, who she manages to look down on for part of their relationship. She was raised in the British educational system. She's trained as a teacher. She's quite convinced that Britain is going to welcome her with open arms and be happy that she's there to be able to help them with their education system.
But the situation is depressingly predictable. It's a dilemma that Gilbert sees, but Hortense walks into it with blithe unawareness.
I understand this is the place I should present myself for a position in the teaching profession.
You're a teacher?
I am. My letters of recommendation. As you will see, one is from the headmaster at my last school.
Sorry, but where are you from exactly?
Jamaica. This letter is written by the headmaster at my last school, and you will
the
see
the school was where?
The Coral Hill Parish School in Kingston, Jamaica. And here is the recommendation from the Alexandria Hall Teacher Training College, which previously I attended under the tutelage of...
Is that also in Jamaica?
Of course, yes.
If you didn't train here, you can't teach here. It's not possible.
If you read the letters, you will see I spent 3 years training to be a teacher. I received distinction in the teaching diploma awarded to me.
I'm sure you did, but your qualifications aren't recognized here. They're of no use to us. The Education Authority make the rules. We must abide by them.
I must train all over again? Is that what you say?
Assuming you are accepted. I must warn you, competition for places is extremely fierce.
Hortense kind of grew on me by the end. But I'd say Gilbert and Queenie are definitely the more likable characters in this show. So, yeah, we'll talk about Queenie Bly, who's played by Ruth Wilson. I couldn't help but think, well, actually all four of them, but especially Queenie somehow, is like a lot of young people right now. She's just getting started with her life, but her options are narrowing due to world circumstances. At the start of the story, we find out that Queenie was raised on a pig farm in the English countryside. It's not to her taste, so she makes her escape to the big city thanks to an aunt of hers. And she has big dreams, but now she's facing the prospect of marrying literally a boar. Just listen in as she keeps shop with her aunt.
The way you are with him, Queenie, so offhand, you'll drive him away.
I know he's decent, Auntie, and dependable. And I'm fond of him, I am. It's just all these months, all our walks in the park, the bus rides, the boat trips. All I know about him is he works in a bank, lives with his father, and likes barley twists. Let him slip through your fingers. And you'll regret it, Queenie. Seize the day. Carpe diem. Carpe diem.
I didn't really think about this until I sat down to get ready for the show, but it's funny that she's given the name Queenie because in a way she represents Mother England. If Mother England were as warm, open-hearted, and broad-minded as Queenie, things would have gone a lot better all around.
Well, actually, in the novel, Queenie details her own childhood. Apparently, her mom wanted to name her Queenie because her mom believed that was the Queen's first name.
I love it.
And even after the vicar explained that the Queen's real name was Victoria, and he christened the baby with that name, well, everyone calls her Queenie. That's how she got her name.
That's almost a Vicar of Dibley moment. Okay. Queenie, she tries to defy the prejudices she sees around her. She lets rooms to black people, a thing that many people didn't do at the time. She stands up to her husband and the neighborhood in order to do it. And she's genuinely curious about the world, and she tries to open herself to new things beyond her small island, even if she has her share of getting it wrong. Before she meets Gilbert and Hortense, she meets a Jamaican RAF officer who is sent to billet overnight at her house during the war. First, the RAF officer plays poker with Queenie's father-in-law, who happens to be mute, and then he stays up talking with Queenie, and Queenie is so hungry for a conversation and companionship. It's in the depths of the war, and here's their conversation.
Now you can ask me all the questions you've been thinking about since I arrived. What? You're not curious about this colored man in your house?
Have you not heard the expression, curiosity killed the cat?
I prefer the one about it having nine lives. I come from an island in the Caribbean called Jamaica. Have you heard of it?
Well, you must miss it. And your family?
Unfortunately, you can't choose your family. Our disappointment in each other is mutual.
Wait, but you must miss being with your own kind.
My own kind?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, being so far from home and...
And you? Do you miss your husband?
Yeah, of course.
So tell me, am I the first black man you ever see?
No. I saw one first on a school trip to the British Empire exhibition at Wembley. They made a jungle with an African village in it.
But the war is raging and Queenie's going nowhere. Even when the war ends, things are bleak across the city. People are living in very substandard conditions as they struggle to recover from the war.
Yeah, it's not a period anybody would want to live through, I'm sure. But really, Queenie maintains her grace throughout the story. All the tough stuff that she faces, and even when she's faced with a dilemma that's even more tangled and fraught than the rest of the story, it's one of the big scenes in the movie. And Ruth Wilson, she just nails the scene and captures all of its complexity. And definitely everybody else in the show is up to her standards.
Well, then there's Bernard, Queenie's husband.
And that's the Cumberbatch character, right?
Precisely. But Bernard is not a character that you're going to love. He's locked into his view of the world, and he's inflexible. He's a timid bank clerk living with his father, and as you mentioned, his father is mute. He suffers from PTSD after his experiences in World War I. When Bernard first meets Queenie, he has feelings that he's never felt before, but that's about as much personal growth as he's going to experience in this story. I found a character profile at litcharts.com, and it calls Bernard the most unsympathetic character of the story. and goes on to describe him in these terms. Hostile to anyone who's not of his own race or class, Bernard typifies the racism and classism that pervade British society. In this respect, he's a notable contrast to his wife, the only white character who attempts, however unsuccessfully, to combat the rampant prejudice that surrounds her. He does try, to a certain extent, to do right by his wife and her son, but Queenie knows that it's not really a sincere commitment.
Queenie, God's name's going on.
She has got to take the baby.
It's the best thing for him.
Oh, his mother, you're the best thing for him. I'll be there to help, I told you. Pity's sake, God's sake.
You say that now when he's just a baby. But what happens when he grows into a strapping young lad with a mind of his own and does something out of order? You'll think you're wog, you black bastard.
No, I would never think such a
thing.
You
won't be able to help yourself, Bernard, because you'll be angry. Angry for all the times the neighbours shunned you, or the bricks thrown through the windows, or the sniggers behind your back. He'll see the anger in your eyes, and he'll know he's the cause of it.
And Bernard has no comeback for that. The look on his face reveals the truth in what Queenie said.
It's pretty devastating. Gilbert, on the other hand, is a much more open character than Bernard, and way more likable. Yeah, he feels like a guy you can depend on. He's got some wit and some creativity.
Gilbert feels that there's more for him than what Jamaica can offer him. He wants to experience more and have greater opportunities. He signs up for the RAF, hoping to be trained as a gunner, and that's what first takes him to England. But he experiences institutionalized racism, and the only assignments he gets keep him on the ground. He's a driver.
That must have been an enormous disappointment. I mean, to sign up to be in the air, right? You're joining the Royal Air Force, and then all you get to do is drive is disappointing.
Yet he sees more opportunity in England than in Jamaica. Now, Queenie wonders why Gilbert and other islanders like Michael, the Jamaican she had met earlier during the war, why they would ever leave their island and head to England.
My friend was from Jamaica too. Yeah, the one Arthur mistook you for. I only met him the one time, but when he talked about Jamaica, he made it sound so exotic. Now, what I want to know is, why would any of you want to leave such a place to come all this way and fight for us?
Well, it's like if you have a relative who lives far away whom you have never met. And this relation is so dear. She's known as mother. On her birthday, you sing and party in her honor. At home and school, everybody talk about her. She's so beautiful, so refined, so cultured. Like the Lord, she take care of you from afar. And she love you all as her own children. And you must work hard to be worthy of her love. Then one day, you hear your mother is in trouble. She calling to you, she need you. So you leave your home and you travel the seas with waves as big as mountains. You are cold and hungry. And you feel for the first time in your mouth a taste of fear. But you know you're doing your duty. That is why we come.
After the war, Gilbert returns to Jamaica. But after his time in England, despite the racism, Jamaica seems too small and too lacking in opportunities for a middle-class man such as him. He decides to return to England when new laws make it seem like he would be welcome there, as we hear in this clip of his conversation with his girlfriend Celia.
I wonder now why I come back here at all. This country poorer now than before the war. Celia, you decided my best chance is to return to England. Look what I see in the paper. The SS Empire Windrush leaving for London on the 28th of May.
That is just a month away.
But the cost of the passage is only £28.10. Of course, that is £28.10 I don't have yet, but I have 4 weeks before that date to find it. Somehow I will get it. I have to get it. Did you know they have just passed an Act of Parliament there? The Nationalities Act, they call it. We Jamaicans are now not just citizens of the Empire, but citizens of the United Kingdom. We're equal to all those born and bred there. We're British now, just like them.
He sounds so hopeful. He's full of hope and plans and rightfully aims to take his place. He's volunteered to be in the war. He's ready to claim his full citizenship.
Of course, the reality that meets him upon returning to England is far different than those dreams.
I have found some English people are not so welcoming to us colored boys now the war is over. At school, we learn everything about the mother country. At age 10, I could recite all the great industrial canals of England.
So he told Queenie how, as a child, he had learned all about the steelworks of Sheffield, the china firms of Stoke-on-Trent, the railways, the parliamentary system of Westminster, and all the great laws which had been passed there.
Not just me. All West Indian children must learn this until they are word perfect.
As Queenie listened, she felt, perhaps for the first time, what it was like to walk in the shoes of another.
When I arrive here, the English, they look at me dark skin and say, ah, you are from Africa. I say, no, I'm from Jamaica in the West Indies. I'm British like you. And their face go blank. And I realize that this mother country about which we Jamaicans know so much does not even know where her own children live. She does not care one jot for us.
Going back to Andrea Levy, the author of Small Island, this is that trauma of the first generation. So having so many assumptions and beliefs that were then met with the unfair, unkind, dismissive reception in the UK, you know, things have moved on. England is a much different place in many ways than it was in 1948.
As a measure of how much things have changed, when Small Island aired in 2009, having two black and two white leads seemed, from reviews of the time, to be pretty earth-shattering.
That was a surprise, right? One of the things I read was the idea of the BBC producing a historical series that didn't have corsets, bonnets, and frock coats was seen as real progress. Considering it's only a 10-year-old show, it was pretty shocking that it was such a shake-up on its release.
I think it certainly revealed some of the ongoing truths about the change and lack of change in England over the decades.
Yeah, it held a lens to the country. It'd be interesting to see that about other countries, including Canada, right? To have more of these kinds of stories told.
It's something that our TV screens and big screens have been lacking. However, in the last few years, there's been a bit of progress telling more diverse stories, and let's hope that that continues.
Here come the holidays.
Island Watch is here to help you out. Visit islandwatchpodcast.com for our amazing island gift list.
Our list is as unique as our show because every gift list item is focused on islands. So how easy is this going to make your holiday shopping? If you know someone who loves islands...
And maybe that's you. You could get a gift for yourself.
Yeah, you sure could. And you could spread the joy around and get some island gifts for people you love. Or people you wish would move away to an island.
Yeah, a nice going away gift.
Everybody's got somebody. Okay, or you can get gifts for any of those frontline workers. All the people who are carrying the day right now.
Whoever it is, we've made it easy to finish your holiday gift shopping. Just go to islandwatchpodcast.com for all our fantastic suggestions.
So, how much of an island visit did you feel from Small Island, Dave?
Well, it's not immediately evident from the physical surroundings that the story takes place on islands, but yet for me there's this pervasive sense of being closed in, the insularity and isolation that can sometimes be associated with being separate, apart, and limited in outlook. In that way, it does feel somewhat like being on an island. Just not in the beach and waves literal sense that we've experienced in some of the other shows we've watched. So I'm giving an island rating of 2 out of 5, view from a coastal highway.
That's interesting, like saying being closed in, being isolated, that those kinds of island associations. I see what you're saying. For me, I thought there are very few scenes in the English part of the story that make you feel like you're on an island. Definitely the Jamaican locations are where the island feeling hit me more, just because of the sun and the open spaces. And then when that sun and open space is left behind, and you're really like, you just feel hunkered down. Everything in England in this portrayal, because most of it is taking place in 1948, everything is sort of like a gray mottled landscape that is post-war London. So from an island point of view, I'm going to give it a 1, a view from a distant hotel window.
We also have our star rating where we ask, would you recommend this show to a friend?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being you can probably find better and 5 being stop binging whatever you're binging and watch this, I'd say I'd give this a solid 3.5. And I have a confession to make, because actually, after researching Andrea Levy, I'd say I'd be more likely to recommend the book. As good as the show is, and the show is good, but somehow in the winter, I really like longer, engrossing, epic-style stories. And from the bit that I peeked at, the book carries a lot more humor than the miniseries. The book is written from the four different characters' points of view, which is another thing I really like. So I heard a reading of some of Gilbert's section, and it actually had me laughing out loud. So how about you? Would you recommend Small Island to a friend?
Well, I haven't read the book yet, so I can't say exactly how the miniseries compares to it, but I found the show quite compelling. The performances by the four main actors were superb. I would certainly recommend it, and I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
It's time to play Find the Island. With so many islands in the world, it's challenging to figure out which to visit. That's why we created this Find the Island segment, to learn more about, or even discover, islands that are new to us. Maybe it'll help choose which islands to visit, either in person or on a future episode of Island Watch. Here's how to play. One of us gives a series of clues about an island, and the other tries to work out what island it is. Best of all, you can play along at home. Today, it's Dave's turn to highlight an island.
This is a really interesting island. I've always been interested in places that are remote from the rest of a country. Outposts, exclaves, and enclaves. This island is part of Country A, but it's connected to Country B by a bridge. So if you're traveling by road, the only way to get to the island from Country A is by going through Country B.
Okay, that's it, right? Okay, so the island is part of
Country A.
Country A, and it's connected by bridge to Country B.
That's correct.
Okay, so these countries can't be terribly far apart. Okay, I have some candidates, but give me another clue, please.
Well, the road access is not really accessible right now because of travel restrictions. But there is seasonal ferry service to the Country A mainland from the island.
Okay, so Country A is a mainland, Country B is an island.
No, the island is part of Country A, Country B is the other country. But because of travel restrictions, the road access is restricted.
Okay, got you. Another clue, please.
Okay, these are pretty obscure, I admit that. Country B once disputed ownership of the island, but that was resolved in 1817. So the relationship between islanders and their neighbors on the Country B mainland have been amicable for a long time. Not really helping you much, is it?
It's not.
Sorry, maybe these are a bit too obscure, these clues, or a bit too cryptic. All right, we'll try this one.
Okay.
A president from Country B liked to visit the island frequently. So when the bridge opened a few decades later, in 1962, it was named in his honor, and it's called the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Bridge. Does that help?
Okay, so Country B is the United States, and just by process of elimination, I'm going to say Country A is Canada.
That's correct. Does that help you to name the island?
Are we talking East Coast or West Coast?
East Coast.
East Coast. Okay, so somewhere like Maine, Nova Scotia.
You're getting really close. You bet.
I remember seeing a thing on the CBC show Still Standing about small towns in Canada having troubles staying alive. And this is ringing a bell, but I cannot remember the name of the island. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yes, this community was featured on that show, and it's called Campobello Island. It's part of the province of New Brunswick, but it's located just off the U.S. coast near Lubeck, Maine, in the Bay of Fundy. And it's the largest and it's the only inhabited island in Campobello, which is a civil parish in southwestern New Brunswick.
How big is it?
It's just 40 square kilometers in size, so it's not very big.
Okay, how many people live there?
It's a pretty small population, only about 900 people. Now, looking back, it was originally populated by the Passamaquoddy indigenous nation. Europeans arrived in the early 1600s, and it became a British territory in 1713. Following the American War of Independence, a number of United Empire loyalists settled there. And there was lots of smuggling during that time, and the British Royal Navy held the island and several other islands in the area during the War of 1812. And I mentioned the dispute over the boundary, but the U.S. and Britain settled that dispute and the status of several other islands in 1817. The island was in private hands in the middle of that century, and then it was sold to a group of American business people in 1881. And then the Roosevelts, who were part of that group, established a summer home there in 1883.
Wait, so Americans own it, but it's part of Canada?
Well, at the time. It was private. Okay. At the time, it was privately owned. That's what gave rise to the connection of FDR with the island. Nowadays, most residents are employed in fishing, aquaculture, or tourism. And the main tourist attractions are Herring Cove Provincial Park and Roosevelt Campobello International Park. There's also a lighthouse and a museum, and bird watching is really popular between May and October. As I mentioned at the beginning of this segment, I'm really fascinated by remote places and geographic oddities and quirks. This border crossing between Campobello Island and the U.S. is the easternmost land crossing between Canada and the U.S.
So I'm trying to think of the logistics, especially now with COVID. How do the Canadians living on Campobello get things like mail right now?
The border is closed to non-essential travel.
Mail feels kind of essential.
So I believe it's able to cross the border. But however, there's been some friction in recent years, even prior to COVID, because the mail coming to the community through the U.S., right, the U.S. began searching packages to and from the island in 2019, and that prompted a lot of outcry from residents.
Yeah, I guess it would. For listeners, if you're interested in seeing that episode of the TV show about Campobello Island, we're going to leave a link in our show notes.
And hopefully post-pandemic, when travel restrictions are lifted, it'll be a little bit easier to visit Campobello Island.
Well, this is a new record for us. Three destinations, Jamaica, England, Campobello Island. What a trip. We're headed back on board now and setting sail for another port. Join us next week for another great Island Watch adventure.
In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at IslandWatchCast. Send us an email. Our address is islandwatchpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to visit our website at islandwatchpodcast.com for show notes and more.
Fair winds and calm seas.
This has been a production of Phosphine League.
Phosphine League.
Phosphine League.
Phosphine League.
Lesson number one, Hortense. This is a chip. Lesson number two. And listen well, Hortense. All they tell us in Jamaica how everything and everybody in England is good, it's not true. You must be ready for that.
I was born ready, Gilbert Joseph.